Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the latest Straight Out of Cobham. It's me, Liam Toomey, once again standing in dutifully for Matt Davis Adams, who has had the temerity to go off and celebrate his 40th birthday party. So you'll have to make do with me and also Simon Johnson. How are you doing, Simon?
Well, I'm here to accept the award for the best supporting Chelsea correspondent. Award.
I thought you were making a Will Smith, Chris Rock reference nice and early there.
Well, I didn't. I was tempted to, but I didn't want to get slapped through the computer screen. So I thought I'd stay away from that and just say that it's all about love. I just want to express love to all the Straight Out of Cobham community, no matter what horrific thing I'm about to say next.
You also won't hear any bald jokes on this podcast.
yeah, nothing about hair. Yeah.
It's not on.
Yeah, poor old... us poor follically challenged people. Someone's got to stick up for us. Will's my champion. Well,
Will Smith certainly did that. Anyway, there is some stuff going on with Chelsea.
Yeah.
I'm told. Even though they're not actually playing any matches at the moment. The big story is still rumbling on. The takeover, the latest developments, the bids have been narrowed down to a final shortlist of four. Although if, you know, judging reports from elsewhere, some people still believe it might be more than that. Our information is that there are four bids remaining. So, Simon, do you want to take us through what we know at this point? I appreciate there's a lot that we still don't, but who's still standing and what does the process look like from here?
Well, the runners and riders have pretty much been the runners and riders all along, apart from one sort of late entry. But Todd Bowley and Hans-Jörg Weiss, Sir Martin Broughton, who are backed by primarily Josh Harris and David Blitzer, although there seems to be quite a number of, on that consortium that we haven't heard about yet. Of course, Seb Coe is involved as well, which might help on the political front, given his connections. The Ricketts family, I don't know whether the listeners have heard about them. They've made a few headlines over the last, well, ever since they've been linked with it. But they're still in it, despite hashtags to the contrary. And then the one that sort of perhaps took people a little bit by surprise, the back end of the, just before the deadline, is the Boston Celtics co-owner, Stephen Pagliuca, is that how you pronounce his surname?
Well, I was going on the old Italy goalkeeper, Pagliuca, Gianluca Pagliuca. Was he a Gianluca?
Pagliuca, yeah, that probably. Anyway, he's minted as well. So we've got these four that have made the shortlist, thank goodness. Although I am personally gutted the goldmine man didn't make it. I was rooting for him. I liked the cut of his jib.
Maybe sent to the same email address as Muhsin Bayrak.
Yeah, well, perhaps the two of them should have got together. That was their big mistake. But yeah, I sort of had visions of Chelsea paying for transfers with a gold bar rather than, you know, old-fashioned transfer bid. But now it sort of gets a little bit slower for a few weeks. It's going to calm down for a few weeks whilst these four bidders, their bids are further assessed. They can actually increase their offer if they want to. As I said before on the show, it's not necessarily the biggest bid wins, but the best overall bid. As has emerged over the weekend, all the bidders are going to have to prove that they can not only buy the club straight away, but that they can commit £1 billion of investment into the club, whether that be put into the redevelopment of the stadium or transfers, etc. Those final bids have got to be in by sort of April the 12th, is roughly the date that's being put out there. And Rain Group hope to name their preferred bidder by the end of April and take it to the government, where, of course, the government could veto it. The Premier League will also run their immaculate fit and proper persons test. But it's all looking like that Chelsea will have a new owner before the end of the season, which is very good because they obviously want to get on with the summer business at hand and try and get convinced players at the last minute to sign a new contract, perhaps.
Yeah, and a new American owner. In almost certain likelihood.
Let's get another American, which obviously did attract some comment when on my trip at Middlesbrough, but those that express anti-American sentiment are going to have to get used to the idea.
Yeah, what I find quite funny about all of this is that, I mean, Paluca seems like quite a low-key guy anyway, judging by, I've talked to people I know who are a bit more familiar with the Boston Celtics, and he's very much there are two owners there, him and Wick Grousbeck. And Grousbeck was the only one I'd heard of. I'd never heard of Stephen Paluca. So he seems very much to be a finance business guy who's only owned Atalanta for about a month. In some ways, it's not a surprise that his name took so long to come out, because he seems to be Abramovich levels of secrecy. What I don't really understand with the Harrison Blitzer thing is that their names are out there now. I don't know why they're still so seem so reticent to be linked with it. I know there are complications with their Palace holding, but they wouldn't be in this race if they weren't confident that they could shift those shares pretty quickly if they needed to. And of course, there's no real point in them shifting them right now because they don't know if they're going to get Chelsea. But it is just quite funny, isn't it, that we've got on the final four shortlist, we've got one option in Ricketts Griffin that a lot of fans have made it clear they don't want, and two options, one of which couldn't currently own Chelsea due to Premier League rules, and one couldn't currently own Chelsea due to UEFA rules. Well, certainly if they met Atalanta. So, yeah, lots more twists and turns to come, I'm sure. And Chelsea will end up with a very rich owner regardless, who will spend time getting to know when the time comes. But let's take some listener questions now while we're waiting for more developments on all of this. I sent out a request, a belated request, an hour before recording, and people flocked to the call. There's one question which is, does anyone know what Ken Griffin's role is in the Ricketts bid? Is he simply lending the money, or would he be a hands-on owner? He has the money to keep Chelsea at or above Abramovich levels if he wants to, but he's been completely overshadowed by the Ricketts stories. Yeah, that's interesting. That's Bucephus has got in touch with that. I have actually been writing about Ken Griffin for a Ricketts Griffin piece that we're running this week. He certainly does have... well, almost three times Abramovich's current net worth and almost double Jim Ratcliffe's net worth, who was, of course, looking at buying Chelsea before he acquired Nice. So he has serious money. I think he's just outside the top 50 richest people in the world. The suggestion is that he has partnered with the Ricketts, and that the Ricketts seem to be providing the sports owner pedigree in this, because of course they've had a measure of success with the Chicago Cubs, although I know they're certainly not universally popular there. And Griffin is the deep pockets. Griffin is the one that gives their bid real liquidity. The interesting thing about him is that he's never really, as far as I'm aware, demonstrated an interest publicly in owning a sports team. He's got lots of other interests. He's got like a personal art collection worth over $1 billion, but he's never really said anything publicly about sports. And he also seems, his investment strategy, I was watching a lot of business interviews over the weekend while I was writing this thing. And he's talking about really knowing what you're investing in, specialized knowledge and all that. That's been the key to his success. He's kind of venturing into the unknown here in terms of European football. So that's another aspect. He's obviously not commented publicly at all, and he's let the Ricketts be the public face of this for better or for worse. but he's certainly a major, major player. And I think he's a key reason why their bid is being taken so seriously, because he is the bulk of the money behind it.
So I'll just jump in there. I was pretty much going to make that point, actually, that given the incredible outcry about this bid, I think you have to read into just how strong the financial package, or certainly what this bid entails, for them to have made the shortlist, despite the level of outcry. They're clearly being taken seriously, even though, you know, it's pretty much known that this is the last bid that people want to win, and that includes, you know, Saudi Media Group, etc., like, you name them. The one sort of bid that fans have been most angry about has been the Ricketts family campaign. And you just sort of think that behind the scenes, it's because, yeah, the bid that they've made is very, very serious indeed. When I spoke to someone, you know, from the Ricketts family side of things about how it would work, they didn't really sort of say, oh, it'll be 50-50 or this, that, or the other. I think it sort of sounded a little bit like it still needed to be worked out how the dynamic would work. But yeah, I think when you've got that amount of money behind you, yeah, you're going to have to listen to what they have to say.
Yeah, well, Ken Griffin, I mean, for people that don't know, he manages one of the biggest hedge funds and securities trading companies in the world called Citadel, that he built pretty much from scratch. And he's been very, very hands-on all the way through with that. He's, you know, he's not a kind of, I think people have a fair degree of autonomy underneath him, but he checks everything. He's across everything. So it'd be interesting to see whether he would take that attitude into this, because obviously this is a realm that he's completely unfamiliar with. But they have to win the bid first, and there's a lot of opposition on that front, and three presumably credible alternatives. So we'll see what happens. Just a broader question from Andy Capp that I'll throw straight over to you, Simon. Why are Americans so obsessed with buying our Premier League clubs, and are Chelsea in danger of being acquired by the latest version of the Glazers? And I know Adam Crafton wrote a piece for The Athletic, didn't he, this morning, about the American wave in the Premier League.
The first part of the question, why not? I mean, the Premier League is massive. You only have to look at how the broadcasting rights in America have taken off. NFL, well, American sports, look at the rise of the Premier League, even though there's obviously still an incredible amount of money in American sports, but the Premier League is sort of one of the most globally recognised leagues in the world. You sort of think of how often pre-COVID Premier League teams would go and tour in America. It's lucrative. Plus, as you sort of already alluded to, the Glazers, they're not the only American owners. So it can be very lucrative to own a Premier League team. Whether the new owner would be like the Glazers, that's obviously a difficult question to answer, because we don't know what everyone's intent and purposes are.
We also haven't seen the offers, so we don't know how much debt is involved.
Exactly. You
know,
when
the Saudi media bid, for example, was tabled, the initial wave of that was that, oh, this is 2.7 billion. You know, they're talking about investing 200 million in the club immediately, and people got excited because of, you know, something Saudi.
People
speaks
just went
money
Newcastle.
To people.
Newcastle, yeah. Mark II, didn't they?
And it's since been reported, not by us, but by, you know, certainly credible people, that their bid was quite heavily debt financed. So we just don't know. The Rain Group are the ones that know what these offers actually consist of and how much money is on the table and how where it's all coming from.
But you get the impression that because it has emerged that Chelsea personnel are involved, like Bruce Buck, etc., that whilst they're not going to have complete say, I can't imagine them allowing Chelsea to be bought by people that don't have the money in place to invest, that it would be some kind of debt arrangement like the Glazers have. In saying that, I appreciate, and this isn't a Man United podcast by any means, but when I sort of hear criticism of the Glazers, and this is from a very, very distant point of view, obviously, I do sort of go, it's not as if United have not spent money in the transfer market. They spent an absolute fortune. It's just the lack of success that's come with it that sort of people were upset about. But yeah, it's very difficult to make a judgment on what kind of owners Chelsea are going to end up with, because as Liam points out, we haven't seen the structure of the bids. But given that one of the provisos is that people, as I said earlier, people have to prove they've got £1 billion to invest in the club, on top of actually buying the club, suggests that no, they've got to be serious owners. They're not going to, and Chelsea, I'm not sure, unlike United, they're not a money making club. This has been shown under Abramovich. You know, they're not, they haven't got, despite all their success, they haven't got that huge global commercial appeal on the same level as United to make loads of money out of.
Ramajama got in touch to ask, any chance of there being a massive U-turn on the part of the UK government with regards to allowing Roman to continue his ownership, given his role brokering peace? First of all, I mean, there's been kind of enough reports from different places in the last few days that it does seem that Abramovich is involved somehow in the discussions that are going on around Russia and Ukraine. The details still seem very, very sketchy. We don't really know what's going on. And of course, Abramovich never, ever speaks himself. So that doesn't really help clear things up. On the central question, though, highly unlikely. The British government is committed, shall we say, to this now. I think they were probably quite late relative to the EU in taking action against Russian oligarchs. But now that they have, I really can't see them going back on it. And the quickest way for Chelsea not to be operating under sanction is to have a new owner as soon as possible. If you want to weigh in, you can, Simon. Otherwise, we'll move
it's
on.
It's a no.
Yeah.
It's a no from me. He's not going through to the next round.
Benji Taylor asks, are we waiting for an official announced shortlist, or will we just get to hear the chosen consortium? I mean, you'd have thought, Simon, if they were going to announce the shortlist, they would have done it already.
Yeah, that should have been done already. Yeah, it feels like we, the media, are sort of announcing the shortlist. Yeah, Rain Group. Yeah, it's been an interesting way of handling the process. I don't quite understand why they haven't been able to be a little bit more. No, we don't expect chapter and verse, do we? We don't expect this bit is, you know, there is a process that has to be kept private. Obviously, one bid can't learn what the other bid is doing, etc. But I don't see what the harm is in officially coming out and announcing these people have made it through and these are the ones we're considering. But hey, this is what it is. They are obviously letting people know in other ways, mainly through the media. But yeah, I'm just pleased that we've at least reached, we've now sort of got to the sort of close to the end game. And I do sort of think as well, there has been an element of talk of frustration of how this is going. And you sort of go, well, this is a huge deal going on here. This is not, if you sort of think of how much work goes into a big money transfer and how long that can take, this is the transfer of a football club and a very successful one.
People who report on takeovers generally are saying this is moving at like breakneck speed.
Yeah. It's just like, can we all just take a step back and go, yeah, we're you know, this isn't going too badly. Okay, for maybe the sort of the daily grind of the sort of little updates can seem like it's taking longer than it actually is. But when you sort of think it's only a month ago that this all basically kicked off in grand scale with Roman sort of initially trying to palm off the club to trustees and then putting the club up for sale. Maybe the standards were set so high 19 years ago with the speed in which Abramovich took over Chelsea, but that was very abnormal. I just think, you know, for Chelsea, as I said, it's important that a few weeks ago there were concerns about what kind of future Chelsea had. Well, it's clearly still going to be a bright one, even though it might not be the Chelsea that has dominated financially in many ways for the last two decades.
Jobs for the Youth asks, besides the palpable red flags associated with each camp, which of them offers the likelihood of continuity in terms of the club's global dominance? To some extent, I think this is unknowable. But, you know, the thing I always look at with sports owners generally, but certainly football clubs, is people that come in knowing what they don't know and, you know, being prepared to hire the right people, or in the case of Chelsea, keep in place the right people and maybe empower them to make football decisions and run the football side and understand really that they are just the money in the equation. And if you look at the different bidders, I mean, you could even say with the Ricketts, they kind of did that with the Chicago Cubs. They hired Theo Epstein, who was a really highly respected general manager, and let him get on with it. And he delivered a World Series. I'm familiar with the NBA. The Boston Celtics have been really well run. So that's maybe a good sign for Stephen Pagliuca, even though he hasn't been the only factor in that. I'm not too familiar with the LA Dodgers, but everything I've heard suggests they've been consistently competitive since Todd Boehly's been involved and quite smartly run. So it doesn't seem like, I mean, there are suggestions that Vivek Ranadive is involved in the Martin Broughton, Sebco bid. The Sacramento Kings have been an absolute joke in the NBA. So I think Chelsea fans should probably hope that he is not front and centre of that. And he's maybe a minority investor at best.
Oh, the reason why I flagged there, Liam, is because you've struck a nerve like you do on a daily basis. When you talked about teams that are hopeless, this is why I'm delighted that Woody Johnson has not made it through, because any of the few followers I have on Twitter may be aware during NFL season that I tweet about the New York Jets in a very pained way on a weekly basis. So when I saw Woody Johnson being interested in Chelsea, it's the only one that I had real passionate feelings about, because the New York Jets are not just one of the most hopeless teams in the NFL. I just think as a sporting, I know this may upset English listeners, but because they get a bit sensitive about the word franchise, but they are one of the most hopeless franchises in sport across the board. And of course, he owns the New York Jets. So, I think maybe my personal lobbying to Rain Group may have helped that one. Yes. Sorry, that was a personal rant there. That was nothing to do with the show.
Hey, if we haven't got personal rants, we've got nothing on this show. It feels to me like the word franchise is only ever used with American sports teams, Marvel movies and train companies.
And the NK Dons.
When they made that move. The one thing I think we can say with certainty, or with a high degree of confidence with the new owners, is that whoever wins this bid is not going to run the club the way Abramovich did.
No.
There is going to be some sort of business plan whereby business decisions have to make business sense. You can't spend £100 million over 19 years sacking managers. You can't have a striker costing nearly You can't have a striker costing nearly £100 million who doesn't fit your team. You can't have the world's most expensive goalkeeper as a number two. You know, things like this that Chelsea could carry during the Abramovich era will not be sustainable in the slightest under new ownership. It will be much closer to, you know, the idealised version, I think, would probably be much closer to what you see at Liverpool. So that's what we'll see. But we don't know who's going to win yet.
Yeah, but basically one of the biggest checks that's going to be written is a reality check. Yes, that's the level of humour on this show.
Dan Hill asked a slightly different question. I'm not going to ask about the takeover.
Good.
Because basically there's so many unknowns, but he wants to ask if players like Rudiger and Azpilicueta are likely to stay under the conditions. What do you think, Simon?
Running out of time, but the window of opportunity is still, or the door is still ajar, is the best I can say. I mean, I think back to an example, until the deal is done, until they're officially elsewhere, there's still time. And I remember Abramovich pitching to Gianfranco Zola in 2003, even though he'd signed a contract with Cagliari, and was actually talking to Cagliari and saying, we'll pay you to get you out of this contract. And Zola said that I've already given my word to Cagliari, I'm going anyway, which is a measure of the man, because you've earned a lot more if you'd stayed at Chelsea. I don't think Rudiger's made a decision yet. Azpilicueta, Barcelona are definitely, we've discussed on the show before, Barcelona are definitely pitching very hard, and it could be a tough sell to turn this around. But you can imagine a new owner coming in and saying, ripping up the over 30s policy and saying, yeah, no, we'll give you 3 years. Stay, we want you as our captain. So I think a new owner is still, there is still some optimism that a deal could be done, but yeah, time is running out.
Yeah, the last I heard, Azpilicueta was thinking very hard about it, because it's a big decision. He's lived in England for 10 years. His family are as much English as they are Spanish.
Yeah.
His kids have grown up here. So it's going to be a difficult one. But fundamentally, if he'd made up his mind, he would have already signed with Barcelona.
Mm.
You know, so I think he still wants to see how the Chelsea ownership situation plays out, potentially meet with the new owners and just see what they think. And you've got until June 30th, haven't you, to actually make a decision. And even beyond that, you know, once he's a free agent, he could still sign back with Chelsea. Doesn't have to go elsewhere. So yeah, it's gonna run for a while.
The only thing I'd add is that, you know, Barcelona, even though they're not Barcelona a few years ago at the moment, bizarrely seem to have money when they don't have any money. But it's still Barcelona. A huge, huge pull for any player, let alone a Spanish player. And with it being World Cup year, you know, a fully fit Reece James next season, that will be one of the factors. You know, that will he get more game time going elsewhere? I noticed the questioner that also didn't ask about Andreas Christensen, as if he's already accepted.
That ship sailed.
That Christensen has already signed that deal with Barcelona. But again, until it's officially pen on paper, who knows?
Final question before we move on, from Cuddly Whiskers.
Oh.
How involved is Tuchel in the decision-making process? We've heard that he's going to meet, or at least talk with the different shortlisted bidders, haven't we? I don't think it's going to be much beyond that. I think it's probably just to give him a sense of what their plans might be, and to give them a sense of what his commitment is. We know what he said publicly about his commitment to Chelsea. Tuchel will not be picking the next Chelsea owners, but whoever comes in...
What, not even in a 3-4-3 formation or something? I've lost producer Lucy, that's it.
He'll reinvent Todd Bowley as a wing-back. But whoever comes in, I think, has to make it a priority to keep Tuchel around, to keep Emma Hayes around. and to keep Neil Barth around. I think those are the three key people. Because across all three departments, they're industry leaders. And that's an incredible luxury to have as a new owner. Usually when you come in, you have to make big changes to key decision makers straight away. Any new Chelsea owner doesn't need to do that. You've already got some of the best in the world working for you. You just have to keep them. Okay, next let's take a quick look at what's been happening during the international break.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
International roundup. There has been football played, and Chelsea players have been involved in that football, I'm told, even though I don't really watch international football. I did, however, see a clip of Italy going out of the World Cup in shocking fashion in a playoff semi-final against North Macedonia, Alexander Tchaikovsky in Palermo. It kind of reminded me a little bit, a spoiler warning for the Star Wars movie that aired 50 years ago, of Luke Skywalker, you know, flying down that valley and hitting that shot perfectly into the exhaust shaft that blew up the Death Star. It was the one place that he could score and absolutely destroy Italy. I'm not comparing Italy to an evil empire, but it was. It did seem like that kind of Hail Mary shot that came off, and it seemed like they were extremely unlucky to lose the game overall. But further disappointment for Italy, and pretty humiliating for Jorginho, you'd think.
Yeah, wasn't it something like 30-odd shots to four or something like that, the stats? But if you're North Macedonia, that's what you do. You know, you stay in the game and hope one chance comes your way. It'd be a bit like sort of Chelsea at home against a Burnley. They got a point at Stamford Bridge, didn't they, from one of their only chances earlier in the season. It's what you do is a Leicester, and it's a great story, not for Italy, but North Macedonia. They haven't got through to the World Cup yet, obviously. But
it's less great if they go out against Portugal in the next round. But it's a lovely moment for them.
Yeah, but I suppose they'd still have the kudos of knocking out the European champions on away from home. But it's a huge shock, and of course, England fans sort of may take some delight in it. From what happened in the European Championship final. But I think a World Cup, it does feel like something's missing if Italy aren't there, if nothing else for the national anthem. So that'll be sorely missed in Qatar.
Speaking of England, did we get a glimpse of Chelsea's future midfield against Switzerland? Conor Gallagher, Mason Mount playing together for about an hour as England came back to beat Switzerland 2-1. What did you make of it?
Well, I suppose I was more Conor Gallagher focused than Mason Mount. I'm so used to Mason Mount doing his thing. I was just sort of really impressed with how Conor Gallagher, his first start at Wembley, just looked like he'd been there before. You know, it's just, of course, he won't get to start at Wembley in a few weeks' time, sadly for him, against Chelsea in the FA Cup semi-final. But I just thought he played for England like he has for Crystal Palace, which is a huge compliment to him, that he wasn't overawed by the occasion, the pressure. I particularly liked the perfectly dinked, measured pass. I think it was to Harry Kane at the start of the second half. It's just sort of like a little pitching wedge, you know, like McGolf, just over the defender with a bit of backspin, so Kane could get there before the goalkeeper. I'd be amazed if he's not a Chelsea player next season. Tuchel loves him. We've talked about Conor Gallagher before on this show. Tuchel loves him. The club thought that a loan would be the best thing for him, so he plays every week. I think he thought that as well, his camp. And it's paid off big time, and Crystal Palace will be, despite their best efforts, I'm sure. Although you could argue, the caveat being, of course, new owners could go, let's rip up the plan A and just cash in on all this talent. But I would be amazed if, for example, in those conversations Thomas Tuchel has with these owners, if he doesn't say, right, these are my plans, and under no circumstances do you sell off the players I want to keep, etc.
Maybe you could have the spectre of Steve Parrish making bids to Josh Harris and David Lipsett to try and get Conor Gallagher.
Yeah, that's it.
Good little dynamic. Kai Havertz and Timo Werner both on the score sheet for Germany. Werner with some interesting comments after the game. There are differences in style of play between the football at Chelsea and here. Maybe the one at the national team suits me better. Here I always have scoring chances. I can score goals. I feel very comfortable here. Probably not the smartest thing he could have said when at a time when he's kind of struggling for regular game time at Chelsea. I mean, it's there for everyone to see that he hasn't been a clean style fit in England in lots of ways. But it feels like comments like this could only push him a bit closer towards leaving in the summer. Do you think?
Well, I think it's quite amusing, if that's the right word, for a player to talk about chances. A player that's missed loads of chances, you know, it's sort of a so it just hasn't worked out, and I can totally understand why he feels comfortable playing for Germany, because he now looks like someone that doesn't want to be at Chelsea, that doesn't feel happy there. I feel quite sorry for him. It feels like the world, weight of the world's on his shoulders when he's out on the pitch with a Chelsea shirt on, whereas you can imagine there's that feeling of relief. Luke Shaw said something similar, didn't he, in terms of playing for England, that he sort of felt more happy being with the England squad because it's a happier place to be than his current club, because United are going through a tough time. And I'm sure, you know, it's basically the same feeling that Werner has. I wouldn't be surprised if he does move back to Germany. Sorry, I realise what I'm saying. In the summer, there will be perhaps Borussia Dortmund, for example, looking for a striker with Haaland probably on his way. So that is one possible avenue for him. The question mark, of course, is, you know, can Chelsea get their money back on a player that hasn't really delivered for two seasons?
And can Werner get his Premier League money in Germany? A couple of other little bits here. Christian Pulisic scored a hat-trick for the USA in a 5-1 win over Panama that puts them basically in the World Cup, unless they lose something like 6-0 to Costa Rica. Their place is assured. A couple of funny things about that game. He scored two penalties. For both penalties, they did the Azpilicueta Havertz ruse, where Jesus Ferreira stood in the penalty area with the ball as the magnet for Panamanian mind games, and then at the last moment handed the ball off to Captain America, who slotted both penalties away really nicely. Might be an idea for Chelsea to actually have Pulisic on the pitch for a penalty shootout next time, because he seems to be quite good at them.
Do you reckon opponents now are going to have to rethink their mind game tactics? Like, they're going to have
just going to have to swarm everyone. It's going to have to be a collective press.
There's going to be some fake mind games people and then the real mind games people there for the actual second penalty person. And it could just, you know, lead to a lot of drama. Will Smith-esque.
You can imagine coaches having to draw up entire plays. You know, certain people blocking off certain takers, other people just saying certain things. Oh, absolute madness. And less good news for Edouard Mendy in Senegal. Bit of a blow for them. First leg of their World Cup playoff against Egypt, a rematch of that Africa Cup of Nations final. They lost 1-0, which means it's all on Tuesday in Dakar. They need to try and come back. And Egypt are a very, very difficult team to score against, as we saw in that tournament. Senegal don't seem to score a ton of goals, so it looks like it could be a bit of a nail-biter there. Almost finished. A final word on the Blues news elsewhere after this.
Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
That is brilliant. Jesse Fleming with number 9. And I think that's the pick of the bunch, that goal. Champion quality from Chelsea there.
Chelsea women equaled their best ever away win with a 9-0 demolition of Leicester. They've now won 5 games in a row since that Conti Cup final defeat. They've got a goal difference of plus 20 in those 5 games. 22 goals scored, 2 against. This was pretty convincing. And they're now 6 different players on the score sheet, including Lauren James. Got a first goal for the club. Nice moment for her. I'm sure it won't be the last. And they're top of the WSL table again for the first time this season. Remarkable that it's the first time this season, but it's the right time to be hitting the front. And they're a point clear of Arsenal with 5 games left. They've got it all in their hands. So it looks like, after a season that's had a fair few disappointments for Chelsea women, they might be, Simon, on the verge of reasserting their domestic dominance.
Yeah. Wasn't it 6-0 at half-time?
Yeah, it was ludicrous.
I'm just wondering what the team talk was in both dressing rooms. What do you say?
Still 0-0.
Go out, win the second half. Is that the thing? I mean, it is a really sort of to their credit, because the men's team have been praised about how they've managed to carry on as normal despite the abnormal circumstances in the background. But the women's team have been doing it as well, remarkably, and Emma Hayes, remarkably so, because as sort of Mason Mount sort of suggested whilst on England duty, you know, it's obviously a concern, but all they can do is what they can do on the pitch. And the women's team, ever since they lost to Arsenal on the opening day, they've been playing catch-up, and they have had setbacks along the way, including obviously in other competitions like the Champions League, the cup final recently against Man City. But yeah, that 9-0 has sent out a real message, hasn't it? And it also done wonders for their goal difference, which could play a part come the final day.
Yeah. Finally, a couple of fixture bits. The dates and times of the FA Cup games for the men and women have now been confirmed. Chelsea will play Crystal Palace on Sunday, 17th of April, with a 4:30 p.m. kickoff. And earlier on that same day, Chelsea women will face Arsenal at 12:30 in the women's FA Cup semi-final at Boreham Wood. And most importantly, Simon, it looks like fans will be at both of those games now.
Yeah, I think it would have been a sort of PR disaster that the FA were desperate to avoid as having a half-empty stadium at both of those games. I just wonder, are there any free buses being put on for, particularly for Crystal Palace fans? It's always a difficult place to get from, you know. It's difficult being a Sunday and all. So,
those trams don't run that far north, do they? Out of Croydon. So just to round off then, what are you working on, Simon, this week? We know the ownership story might be slowing down a little bit, but we'll still be writing about it, won't we?
You mean apart from my terrible gags that need a bit of work? yes, I'll be joining in the profile of the owners, the prospective owners. I'm not sure when it's coming out, but there has been a sort of an initial piece put out there on the Athletic, where Kieran Maguire, the sort of renowned football finance expert, has come up with an algorithm to work out what transfers are worth from sort of start of Premier League era to now. So you can now have a comparison. So I've written about Chelsea, obviously. I had to provide the three biggest transfers of each Premier League season, and then it got transferred into a modern figure. So it might not surprise too many people that the most expensive signing according to this algorithm is still Andrei Shevchenko, with Fernando Torres a narrow runner-up. But I decided to focus on Chris Sutton as perhaps the worst signing, certainly as a centre-forward in Chelsea's history. He came in at, I think he's well in the 80 million, 80-odd million. I haven't got the number to hand. But he scored a mighty three goals for Chelsea. And only one of them was in the Premier League. The other two was against... This is like a quiz question. Where's Matt? Hull City in the FA Cup, where he laughably did a shushing gesture, and Skonto Riga in a Champions League qualifier. Yeah. I thought it was too easy to go down the positive route of who's the best value.
Yeah, so as referenced earlier, I'm working on a piece about the Ricketts Griffin bid. That's with Matt Slater, our sports business guru. I might also be writing about Christian Pulisic, and later this week I'm being sent abroad on a secret assignment. So I'll leave that as a little teaser for you.
Are you the next Bond?
Sadly not. well, maybe not if you watch the latest Bond movie. I've got to stop spoiling movies. We'll stop here. Thanks a lot for listening. I believe I will be hosting again on Thursday because Matt Davis Adams continues to slack off. So I'll talk to you again.
The Athletic.